This week's parasha is Parasha Shlach, because there is between Parasha Shlach, the Sikha Parasha Shlach, Tavshin and Aleph, there are a number of things which run through the Sikha. As I said, we're not going to have time to cover all the points. But the thing that the Rebbe opens the Sikha with is the fact that one of the things that Rebbe always emphasizes is the fact that the entire Torah is called the Torah Achas. The Torah is all one. And that includes the entire Torah. Particularly each individual parsha is a self-contained entity, even though we sometimes have to dig a little deeper in order to see how all the different parts of the parsha connect, or how one part of Torah connects with all the other parts. But the Rebbe says specifically in this week's parsha, in Parsha Shlach, it is more manifest, this idea that each parsha is a self-contained entity, as we actually have. Parsha Shlach is the only parsha which almost the entire parsha deals with one story. It deals with the story of the Meraglim. And even after the story of the Meraglim, it continues on and talks to the parsha of Nesachim, the wine which is poured on the Mizbeach together with the Karbonos, with the sacrifices. And as Rashi explains it, this commandment leads in with the statement that when you will arrive in the Holy Land, you should bring together with your sacrifices, you should bring these wine offerings, these pourings. So Rashi explains that was in order to reaffirm the fact that even though they were told that they're going to be delayed in the desert for 40 years, but still to reiterate the promise that they would enter into Eretz Yisrael. So that also continues from the story of the Meraglim. And the end of the parsha, which we have the parsha of Tzitzis, so the Rebbe says that the parsha of Tzitzis is the mitzvah of Tzitzis is a mitzvah which is said it's compared to the entire Torah. And so again, which emphasizes and highlights this idea that all of Torah is one entity and it's all connected. And particularly in the mitzvah of Tzitzis, which, as we say, that the knots and the strings together equal to 613, which allude to each of the mitzvahs. And the Torah tells us that by seeing the tzitzis, this reminds us to do all of the mitzvahs. So we see how there is this theme of unity within Torah that runs through, particularly in this week's parsha. We have to understand what exactly is the connection between the parsha of tzitzis with the other parts of the parsha. So, in order to explain this, it ever goes off onto the story of the Meraglim itself. We actually read in the parsha the story of the Meraglim that Moshe Rabbeinu sent. And in Haftarah, we read the story of the Meraglim, the spies that Yeshua sent. It ever goes through, pointing out a number of differences between the two events. First off, that Moshe Rabbeinu sent. That Moshe Rabbeinu's sending of the spies, as Rashi explains, that when he asked the Eibush that he should send the spies, the Eibush said, it's up to you. It's your call, it's your decision, you decide. On the other hand, Yeshua, it says, that certainly, after seeing what happened with the spies that Moshe sent, certainly he would not have sent spies on his own, even though it doesn't state explicitly in the Navi that he was commanded to send the spies. Still in all, it's brought in Svarim, and the Alter Rebbe brings it with the Torah. Still in all, we could assume that after seeing what happened with the spies that Moshe sent on his own, that Yeshua would not have sent spies unless he was actually commanded to do so. So the first difference is that Moshe sent them on his own, it was his decision, and Yeshua was commanded to send the spies. There are a number of other differences in the story. One is that it says that Moshe only sent the spies to look at the land. It says when the Jewish people asked for spies, that he asked for spies that will the Yachperu Asar, that they will spy out the land. And it says that when Moshe Rabbeinu sent the spies, he only told them Lasur Asarix, which is to see the land. In fact, we see that they did not hide. They went openly. They didn't hide in any way. They didn't try to conceal their presence. They traveled openly. They didn't mix amongst the population in order to find out their secrets. He said, go see what the land is like and bring back its fruits. Whereas by Yeshua specifically sent them to go in a way, to go in secret. And it says, Miraglim Charash. And that he said that they should conceal themselves. Also, one of the explanations of why they're called Charash is because he told them to pretend to be deaf mutes, so that people will speak openly in front of them and they'll be able to pick up the secrets of what the people are saying. And in fact, they actually had to hide while they were there. We also find that, and there it says specifically that their job was to spy out the land and what the people are saying. We also find that Moshe Rabbeinu sent 12 spies, and the 12 spies that he sent were leaders, a leader from each sheva, whereas Yeshua sent 2 spies, and the pasuk doesn't even tell us who they are. We know from Chazal, we know that it was Pilchas and Kalev, but the pasuk doesn't even tell us their names. It just says they were Anoshim. So he sent 2 people to be spies. Whereas by Moshe Rabbeinu, it emphasizes that they were leaders of the Jewish people, they were leaders of their tribes. It tells us their names. And similarly, in the way in which they carried out their spying, that all the Jewish people knew that they were going, and they came back to report. They reported to the entire people, whereas the spies of Yeshua were only sent by him, and they only reported back to him. It wasn't public knowledge either amongst the Jewish people, nor was it public amongst the people who they were going to spy, that the spies of Yeshua did it in a hidden way. There are a number of other points that the Rebbe brings up. But so in order to explain all these differences, the Rebbe says that there's actually 2 reasons why, in anticipation of a conquest of a land, to send out advanced scouts or spies. There are 2 basic reasons. One reason to send out scouts is to find out about the land, to find out what kind of land is it. Is it a good land? Is it a fruitful land? Is it a land that's worth conquering? And the reason we want to know this is, first of all, we want to know if it's worth conquering, and second of all, if we're going to conquer it, we want to go to conquer it, we want that the people should be eagerly anticipating and looking forward to the conquest, that they should be happy, and they should be excited and enthusiastic about the land that they're going to conquer. The other reason to send advanced scouts or spies is the more obvious reason, which is to find out the lay of the land in order to know the weaknesses, what's the best way in terms of to gather military intelligence, in order to know what's the best way to conquer the land, what's the best way to approach it, what are the people saying, are the people afraid, are they afraid, are they not afraid. So the second reason for sending spies is to gather secret intelligence and information in order to know about, to know the best way to go about conquering the land. Then it says that these 2 different purposes for spying is the difference between the two sets of spies, the spies that Moshe Rabbeinu sent and the spies that Yeshua sent. The spies that Moshe Rabbeinu sent were sent only in order to come back and inform the people about how good the land is. That was their job, not to figure out how to conquer the land.
Why?
Because we don't need to know how to conquer the land if the cloud of glory is going before us and leading the way. And as we know that Moshe Rabbeinu said, and when Hashem said to him that I will send my malach with you to go before you into Eretz Yisrael, Moshe Rabbeinu refused. He insisted that Hashem, Shechina, be present and not just send the Malach. So everything was going to happen in a miraculous way. So it wasn't relevant to know how to conquer it, whether the people are fearful or not. It was irrelevant. Military intelligence was not something that was needed to be gathered. In fact, the Jewish people, it says that when they ask, later in Sefer Dvarim, when Moshe Rabbeinu rebukes the people for asking, he describes their request as asking to spies the Yachbaru Lanu Asaras. They asked for Moroccan, they asked for spies, and they asked that those spies, the Yachbaru, the same root as the word to dig, which means to go in a hidden way and ferret out secret information. They were asking the spies to go ahead in order to spy out the lay of the land for the purpose of conquest. Moshe Rabbeinu did not agree to that. What Moshe Rabbeinu agreed to was to send people just to see that the land is good, as the Ramban explains, so that when they come back and inform the people of how great the land is, the people will go with joy and enthusiasm and excitement. They'll want to go. But to find out military intelligence was irrelevant because it was going to be miraculous in any case. The Eibishter was going to do the fighting, and it was not relevant to know to gather military intelligence. That is why we find that Moshe Rabbeinu, they asked for people who will spy out the land. Moshe Rabbeinu said he's sending people to, that he stated explicitly that he's sending them to look it over. To look it over to see its qualities, to see its properties, in order to come back and bring the good news about how great the land is. The Eibishter himself said, I don't need spies, because I told you already that it's good. What do we need spies for? To come back and tell the people that it's good. I already said that it's good. For conquest, you don't need it because I'm doing the fight. To find out that the land is good, what do you need to send people for? I already told them that it's good. So it's up to you. If you think that it's going to serve any purpose, then you can send us. The Moshe Rabbeinu felt that obviously to spy out the land is not relevant, but just in order that the people should have a more positive outlook, that the people should look forward to going in, therefore he felt it was worth it to send spies. That's why he sent 12. So actually, they were more in the form of scouts rather than spies. He sent 12. And he told them, what did he tell them to find out? He told them to find out about the land. Is it a good land or not? And even when he asked if it's a strong or weak land, Rashi explains that he wasn't, the way Rashi explains it, he wasn't asking militarily, are they a strong people or a weak people? Yesh Eretz Megadelos Giborim, Yesh Eretz Megadelos Chalosh. Is it the kind of land that those who live on it grow to be strong, those who live on it grow to be weak? He wasn't telling them to find out about the people, he was telling them to find out about the land. And similarly, when he asked, are there a lot of people there, or are there only a few? Again, Rashi explains that Yesh Eretz that has many marbul chlusim, it has, generates a large population, and there's a land that only generates a smaller population, only sustains a smaller population. So Rashi keeps bringing back that the questions were all about the land. And even when he said to see if they live in fortresses or in open cities, again, Rashi explains, because that will be the real indicator if they're actually strong people or weak people. And this again refers back to the question of the land. Is it the kind of land that produces strong people, or is it the kind of land that produces weak people? And that's why Moshe Rabbeinu told them to bring back fruit. He told them to bring back fruit because the whole purpose of the mission was to show and to demonstrate to the people that the land is a good one. And this is why he sent 12, one from each shevet, because the leader of each tribe, the leader of each shevet, is responsible to his individual shevet in order to be able to report back to the people in general and to his own individual shevet just how good the land is, because each one is familiar with his own shevet and what their needs and requirements are and what's good for them. So each one will be able to come back and give a general report and a personalized report to their shevet. And again, there was no reason to conceal their mission. Their mission was public. All the Jewish people knew that they're going. And they came back to report to the entire Jewish people. It wasn't a secret report. It was a public report. And similarly, when they went into the land, there was no reason for them to hide themselves. They knew that that there's no reason to be concerned about a sakana, about danger in the way of Bederach HaTeva, the potential danger that there is in the natural order of things, because they knew that all of this is supposed to be done in a miraculous way. And in fact, it says that Hashem made a miracle, that they were burying, that people were dying, and they were busy burying people so that they should be distracted from these people who are walking around. But they were noticed, as they said, and we heard them say that, oh, there are these little grasshoppers that look like people walking around. So people saw them, and they just walked around openly from one end of the land to the other, and you know, brought back the fruits, which, as Rashi explains, that the fruits that they brought back, okay, it says that a person, that the people at that time were strong enough to lift rocks that weighed 40 saw, and what you can carry on a pole is three times the amount. So they were brought back, they came back schlepping these massive fruits, and they made no attempt to hide their presence, they're coming and they're going. They made no attempt to mingle amongst the population or to hide themselves. Because again, the fact that the conquest was going to be done in a miraculous way was obvious. The whole issue was to come back and report about just how good the land is. And in fact, that's what they came back and did. They came back and they said that the land is a good land, and it also flows with milk and honey. Now, if they would have just stopped there, everything would have been fine. The problem is, they started adding additional commentary about how, whether or not they thought it was possible to conquer it. And whether it's the literal meaning or the deeper meaning according to Hasidus, that the land is, that they were concerned that they didn't want to be involved in the gashmius of the world, because they felt that if they preferred life in the desert where they were involved in Torah mitzvahs more on a spiritual level, there were no opportunities to do the mitzvahs in a physical way. So they were concerned about going into a land where they would have to give up their full-time immersion, their total immersion in spiritual activities, and they'd be involved in plowing and planting and gutting and physical mitzvahs. And they were concerned that that is something that they would not be able to deal with. So the problem is that they did not, that they added on to their mission. Their mission was to only come back and comment about how good the land was. And in fact, when Kalev and Yeshua tried to refute them, their main claim was, Kalev ha'aretz ma'od ma'od, land is very, very good. What will be about conquering the land? Hashem is with us. That's not the issue. The issue is not conquering, because that Hashem is with us, we're not afraid of them. But about the land itself, we should know the land is very good. The spies of Yeshua, on the other hand, the spies of Yeshua went specifically in secret. Their identities are not revealed, even in it's only in Parashat Balfeh that we know their identities. They went in secretly. They did not go to check out the whole land. They only went to Yericho, because that was the key to Eretz Yisrael. That, you know, was, any military success would have to begin through Yericho. And they went to find out what the strengths and weaknesses are. And actually, once they heard that everybody was, that the inhabitants of the land were completely terrified of the oncoming Jewish people, so their job was already done. They didn't even have to circulate anymore. They would just hit out for 3 days until those who were looking for them returned, and then they were able to come back, and they reported directly to Yeshua privately, saying, listen, there's nothing to worry about. Everybody's afraid over there. We can just walk in and clean house. According to the Hasidic interpretation, as we mentioned before, they were concerned about the fact that their fear wasn't that about actually conquering the inhabitants. Their fear was about, do we have the wherewithal to conquer the physicality of this world? Dealing with having to live your life involved with physical activities and worldly activities, Gashmius has a way of pulling a person down, and the expression that they use is that it's a land that consumes its inhabitants, meaning that we're going to get pulled, that we're afraid we'll get pulled down into the Gashmius, and instead of elevating the Gashmius, what will happen is the other way, the Gashmius will pull us down. They went so far as to say that that even the Eivishta, it says that the owner can't remove his vessels from them. So in the literal pshat, it's a funny expression. According to Chassidus, the wording fits very nicely because it's explained that the sparks of holiness which fell into the physical world are from the breaking of the vessels. That's where the sparks of holiness originate from, that fell, those lofty sparks that fell into the physical world. So what they were saying is, from Yahweh, Ein Baal Abayis, Yahweh, Ein Tzim Kelo Vishal. Even the Eivishter could not remove his vessels, those sparks, because they felt that it had fallen too low. And if we get involved with these lowly activities, not only will we not be able to elevate those sparks, those vessels, but we will actually get pulled down into the Gashmis as well. So that was their primary concern. So the Rebbe says like this. So what is this? What does all this mean spiritually? Why is it? What is the real spiritual reason? Why did Moshe Rabbeinu see it necessary to convince the people that the land is good? The Rebbe explains that in the process referred to in Kabbalah, the student says birurim, which is to refine and to elevate, bring out the godly potential and the spiritual potential that is hidden in the physical. There's two steps to the process. One is that you have to, in Hasidic terminology, it's kiruv hamavar el hamizbar. Let's use an easier concept that everyone can, an easier mushroom. When you want to influence somebody, when you want to influence somebody, there's two steps to the process. First, you have to get close to them. You can come into somebody and just start telling them about Torah and about Chassidus and about everything. Whatever effect you can have is not going to be a permanent, lasting effect. Maybe at the moment, you grab a person, you put on tefillin with them, you get them to light Shabbos candles, you do. Which is, these are things that we have to do. But the point is, if you want to develop, if you want to have a lasting effect, you really want to change a person, the first thing you have to do is get close to them. You have to win them over. Once you get close to the person and you win the person over and you have the person's trust, then you can take it to the next step, and that person is now open to receiving everything that you have to do. So the first step, or in another Hasidic terminology, that the bearer of the tachta has to come, it's not enough that it come from above. You want to elevate something lowly. You can't just pour in light, so to speak, from above. What you have to do is you have to first get down on the level of the tachta. You have to get down on their level and elevate them somewhat until they're ready to receive. You have to give. Okay, but the point is, again, that there's two steps in the process. If you're trying to refine something lowly, in the process of refining the physical world, it's the same way. We have to descend into the physical world. We come into physical bodies. We are involved in the physical world. We have physical needs so that we can really relate to the physical world. But our job is, and therefore elevate it, but our real job is to bring the light of our neshama down into all those physical activities that we're engaged in. So there's two steps to this process. One is relating to the lowly and elevating it, connecting to it on its level so that we can elevate it. Then we can bring in the revelation from the higher level and complete the process of refining the world. So there's two steps. One is elevating the world. The other is bringing godly revelation into it. So, Rebbe explains that the first step in the process that Moshe Rabbeinu sent the spies was in order to create by the people, that the people should develop an appreciation and a desire for the land, that they should relate to it, that they should want it, that they should go in willingly with joy and with desire, to have an appetite for the land. In other words, that the first step of the process is that they should be able to relate to the land. The next step in the process, which is the actual conquest of the land. Conquest of the land is already more the idea of overpowering and bringing in, that corresponds to the second step of the process, which is bringing the godly revelation down into the actual physicality of the world. So the Rebbe says that we can actually, in these two steps of the process, we can actually talk about the kayak, the godly powers that we have for each step of the process, actually two different godly powers. We know that there's godliness as it's completely above the world. And at that level, nothing else, we say that nothing exists outside of God. Everything, God is one. There's nothing that's separate from Him. God is everything and everything is God. On that level, when we relate to godliness as it higher than, transcends, above the world, at that level, God is everything and everything is God. Then there is the godliness that's invested into creation. The godliness that's invested into creation is tailored into each aspect of creation has its own unique divine energy, as expressed through the unique letters of its name, the process of its creation. Every aspect of existence has its own unique divine energy that's invested in it. So at that level, we're talking about the divine energy which relates to the world on its level and actually is diversified in many different aspects, many different forms and manifestations of godly energy. So we can talk about Elokus, which is on a level of Achdus, of unity, all incorporated. Hashem is everything, God is everything, everything is God. The aspect of godliness as it lowers itself and relates to our existence, which in a world of tremendous variety and diversity and multiplicity, so that aspect of godliness is expressed in differing ways, or in a certain terminology, in a way of Hitzchalkus. So there's two aspects: is God, as you relate to God, in the way of Achdus, the aspect of godliness is completely above the world, and the world is incorporated and included within God. And then there is the godliness which manifests in a way of Hitzchalkus, which is the godliness that's invested into creation and all of its diversity. That explains that the part of the process which is relating to the world, the power that we have to relate to the physical world and operate within a physical world on the physical level, that aspect, that divine energy which gives us power, the divine empowerment to deal with those things, comes from the godly aspect which manifests in a way of the sculptors. We could deal with the physical world on its level, with all of its different situations and all of its different elements. Then there is our capacity to bring godly revelation into the world. That capacity that we have to bring godly revelation into the world, that divine empowerment comes from the aspect of godliness which is on the level of Achdus, of unity. On that level, there is nothing separate. There is no diversity. The only thing that exists is within the Jewish people, within the soul of the Jewish people, we have the same phenomenon. The differences between one Jew and another, on the level of the soul, all Jews are connected. All Jews are one. Where do the differences between one Jew and another come in? On the level of the physical body. But even within the soul itself, when we talk about differences between one Jew and another, what are we talking about? We're talking about the differences in one person's intellect, is more developed, another person's intellect is not as sophisticated, not as developed. One person's love and fear of God is on one level, another is on a different level. The differences between one Jew and another, even on the level of neshama, has to do with the seichel, the midos of the neshama. But the essence, on the level of the essence of the neshama, all Jews are one. So the Rebbe says, this is expressed in our divine services. This is expressed in our divine service as well. There's an aspect of our divine service in which we relate to the divine reality. That's through the study of Torah. The study of Torah, we're not relating so much to the physical reality, we're relating to the way God sees the world. In the actual mitzvahs that we do, we have to deal with all the different physical things that exist in the world. We have to deal on the level of hiskalkus, of diversity, of variety, of dealing with each thing differently. Each thing has its own laws and its own requirements. When it comes to mitzvahs, we're operating on the level of relating to and dealing with the physical world on its level, each thing according to the way it needs to be dealt with. The study of Torah, we're just involved in the study of the divine wisdom. That's more on the level of Achdus. From the perspective of Torah, God is everything, everything is holy. As the Rebbe always says about on the Rashi in the beginning of Talmud, Yaakov Esav Ha'amurim B'Parsha, that Esav, as he is in Torah, is also holy. The word Esav in Torah is just as holy as the word Yaakov. They're equal in their holiness in Torah, because from the perspective of Torah, as everything is contained within Torah, it's all contained within the godly reality. There is the revealed portion of Torah, which deals with the laws that relate to the physical reality, to the physical world. And the revealed portion of Torah deals with countless different situations and different laws and different issues. And then there is Panemius HaTorah, the deeper dimension of Torah, which deals with exclusively the knowledge of God. All it deals with is the divine reality. So within Torah itself, we can make a distinction between the revealed portion of Torah, which relates more to the reality of the world, which is expressed in its Kalkos, whereas in Panemius HaTorah, we are relating more to the divine reality, which expresses that element of Achdus. So the Rebbe says what the story of the Meraglim relates to all of our work in Torah. It's not just an isolated story, not just an isolated event. The Rebbe says certainly such great people, who it says that they were very great people, and they were so great that even after they sinned, and it says that because they sinned, they have no share in the world to come. It's brought in Kabbalah and Chassidus that what it means that they have no share in the world to come is that they were on such a high level that the revelations of the world to come for them wouldn't even be a reward. It wouldn't be considered a reward for them because they were on a higher level. So we're talking about such great people, and we're talking about a mission that was initiated by Moshe Rabbeinu. And Hashem said to him, it's up to you, you decide. So obviously, we can't say that the mission was a total failure. So the Rebbe says that we see they actually fulfilled their mission. They completed their mission. They did the first stage. It took 40 years later that the Jewish people actually went in with the excitement and enthusiasm and for the land from the report that they heard 40 years earlier. But the fact is they did accomplish the mission that they sent out to do. The problem is that they interfered with the timing, and it didn't actually take place for 40 years later. But they did accomplish their mission. Meaning that the miraculous that Moshe Rabbeinu sent represents the empowerment that we have to conquer the physical earth, to conquer the physical world, and to reveal the godliness that is contained within. The spies of Torah, we read the spies of Yeshua sent. This is what empowers us to do the next step in the process of conquering the land. The first step is actually being able to relate to the land on its level and elevate the physical, and the next step is to be able to bring the divine revelation into the world. this is what we take from the Meraglim, that both the Meraglim Moshe Rabbeinu and the Meraglim Yeshua is this power to complete the promise. The Rebbe says now that we've already reached the point that we're standing on the brink of entering into Eretz Yisrael, entering into the true and complete redemption, certainly we have the power to complete the process, not only in terms of elevating the land from down below, but especially bringing the divine revelation from above. The Rebbe says, as we explained, that this is through Torah mitzvahs in general, but in particular, through the study of Pnimius HaTorah, through the revelation, the spreading, the revelation of Chassidus, the awareness of God on the level of divine unity, and also working amongst ourselves, revealing that unity within ourselves and amongst ourselves, through unity and love of our fellow Jews, revealing the divine unity in the world. By spreading Chassidus, certainly we can and will immediately complete the process and merit the full and complete revelation of Mashiach.